Greetings, everyone. Welcome back to our class on the book of Daniel. We'll be jumping into chapter 7 and, of course, the start of the apocalyptic section, otherwise known as the particularly challenging section of Daniel. It's chapter 7 through 12. We're going to have lots of good stuff to talk about today and in the weeks to come. So especially for this section, just be patient if we slow way down. And if I'm relying heavily on a commentary for some of the historical descriptions, it's because I think that that's the most efficient way to transmit the information to you. Some of this just can't be transmitted by way of, well, trust me. And that you have to understand the argument as it flows. So we'll look at this vision of the four beasts and how it parallels the vision of, remember, the colossus or the great statue in Daniel chapter 2? And it was divided into four kingdoms, and here we have four beasts. So we'll see the interface between those two visions as we open up today. We begin in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Okay, so we brought Daniel 6 to a close last week. Of course, you have Daniel saved from the lions. And King Darius, now this is of the Medo-Persian Empire, is giving praise to God. So if you just look at 25, King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, languages that dwell in all the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion people are to tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed." And that continues to emerge as a major, if not the major, thesis of Daniel, that all world history and all the major ruling powers of the earth are completely subject to God, completely subject to his reign, and ultimately have their destiny to be reigned and ruled over by Christ. So his kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. We know that he lived at least until the third year, maybe a bit beyond that, of Cyrus the Persian. So Daniel, at the conclusion of chapter 6, is likely in his 80s, which should give you, if you're up there in years and you're thinking, I'm past my usefulness, not necessarily so. Here's Daniel in his 80s, still doing wonderful stuff, including being bold in the face of the lions and saved by the angel of the Lord, if you recall, the prefigurement of Christ our Savior. Okay, as we go into chapter 7 then, you see in the first year of Belshazzar. So Belshazzar was introduced in chapter 5, verse 1. In fact, if you want to just flip back there quick, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. This is his big party where he's carousing. And of course, outside the gates, the Medo-Persians have already gathered. He thinks that he's going to be saved by his army, by his power, by his gods. He, of course, insults the one true God by taking the captured vessels from the temple and abusing them. And then, of course, the human hand out of thin air appears. And you can read the writing on the wall. And it says, of course, that he is doomed. And so that's the same Belshazzar. That's the end of his reign, obviously. That's the same Belshazzar that is referred to in Daniel 7, verse 1. But of course, here we're back in time, even earlier than that episode, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Okay. So putting us back in the Babylonian mindset then helps us understand how what follows in verse 7 really has to do with what came before in chapter 2, which, if you recall, was the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Just, it'll be this important for us that we should go back and look at chapter 2, verse 31, just to have this as background information as we go into the next section. So Daniel 2:31, we have the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. That's the idol or the colossus that I refer to from time to time. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold. So there's the first unit. Its chest and arms of silver. There's the second unit. Its middle and thighs of bronze. There's the third unit. Its legs of iron. Its feet, partly of iron and partly of clay. There's the fourth unit. Legs of iron, feet of iron and clay. Verse 34, as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand. And it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Okay, so these great earthly kingdoms are brought down by Christ and by this lowly stone. You can look and see, too, this contrast that you have gold, this precious metal, silver, this precious metal, bronze, this semi-precious metal, and, of course, iron metal. And this stone shatters these metals and then becomes a mountain that fills the whole earth. So this little tiny stone cleft, cut out but without human hand of the Virgin Mary, ends up shattering these great kingdoms, and then his kingdom endures forever and takes over the whole earth. So that's the period in which we're in right now. Of course, we're waiting, as the Lord is in a certain sense, for God the Father to make all his enemies his footstool. And the final enemy, of course, to be put away, to be destroyed, is death. So just to read a little further, verse 36, this was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power and the might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given. I mean, isn't that interesting? What do we say at the end of the Lord's Prayer? Thine is the, yours is the, so it doesn't properly belong to the king of Babylon. It belongs properly to Christ. Verse 38, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar / Babylon is the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you. That second kingdom, of course, we already saw in the narrative. That's the Medo-Persians. And that's the silver. And yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And that's, of course, going to be Alexander the Great and the Greeks. And there shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And that, of course, is going to be Rome. So that's taken us through the entire intertestamental period, as you can see. So the Bible does give us a history of the intertestamental period. Of course, it's looking forward to that from the vantage point of Daniel's historical setting. Continuing in verse 41 with this fourth kingdom, and as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom, but some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. Okay, so important to view here at this point that you have the head, which is made of one material, gold, and then the the torsos and the arms. I've already lost it here. Sorry, the chest and the arms. That's what it is. Silver, all one material, and then of course the middle and the thighs, bronze, all one material. The fourth kingdom is not like the others, is it? Because it's mixed materials. And we're going to see that parallel come up now in Daniel 7. So we're going to see the same fourfold structure. We're going to see the fourth is not like the first three. And we're going to see then very clearly that Daniel's talking about the same thing in 7 as he was talking about in 2. The difference is in 2, he's describing it to Nebuchadnezzar in the most charitable possible way. In 7, he's giving the perspective of what it looks like from the saints of God. So you're going to see these not as glorious kingdoms and precious metals, but you're going to see these as fierce beasts afflicting the earth. All right, so that's the backdrop. As we turn back to chapter 7, just so you don't think this is the wit and wisdom of Rhodey or the wit and wisdom of Steinman, who wrote the Concordia commentary, but this is ancient wisdom and ancient reading of this text. Look down at your study note on chapter 7, toward the bottom left hand. Let's just read that. That's abbreviated for Hippolytus. And he says, in distinguishing the kingdoms that are to rise after these things, he showed also the coming of the Antichrist in the last times. So we'll see that emerge in this text of Daniel 7. And the consummation of the whole world. Now, if we set Daniel's own visions also side by in chapter 7, also side by side with this, chapter 2, we shall have one exposition to give of the two together, and shall be able to show how concordant with each other they are and how true. All right, so that's Hippolytus saying we have to read 2 and 7 together. It only makes sense. And then Luther comes next. Luther says, in the 7th chapter begin the visions and prophecies of the future kingdoms. Again, this is of Daniel's perspective. Especially of the kingdom of Christ, for whose sake all these visions came to pass. To begin with, the four kingdoms which he pointed out above in chapter 2 in the great image, he now sees again in another form, namely in the four beasts. Okay, I think that's sufficient setup to have a profitable read then. So chapter 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, which is 553 BC, if that's of abundant importance to you. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Okay, is the great sea poetic for just all waters? Is the great sea The Mediterranean Sea in specific. These have various strengths and weaknesses to them. The position Steinman takes on a comparative textual basis is that the sea would ultimately be the seas of people that inhabit the earth. So those are three options for you to consider. I don't really have one. I maybe even slightly go toward the poetic here. But when you think of a great sea that's going to be churned by winds and the beasts coming out of it, you can see why then the book of Revelation says, in the new heavens and new earth, there will be no sea. The sea will be no more, as a reference to this. Not that there's not going to be an ocean in the new heavens and the new earth, but that the demonic abyss, the demonic sea spoken of in Daniel, from which the beasts come, this will be no more. Be no more tyranny, no more tyrannical governments, no more great enslavements of humanity, great murderous rampages of nations that in spiritual form look like ravenous beasts. All that will be put away. That's what Revelation's getting after when it says the sea will be no more. Okay, so here we go. Again, then, verse 2, the four winds of heaven. So the four corners of the earth, the four winds of heaven. I mean, there's lots of biblical reference here, and including Revelation. Revelation just throughout this entire section. There's hardly a word or an image that doesn't have resonance somewhere in Revelation. But you've got these four winds, and they're stirring up or churning the great sea. So the great sea is anything but peaceful. It's just tossing and turning, tempestuous, huge waves and winds. And the four great beasts came up out of the sea. So in this sense, they're not really born of God. They're born of this chaotic abyss, these peoples, this evil, however you want to see it, the evil masses of people, the demonic churning darkness and mystery. That's their origin. They come up out of the sea, different from one another. Okay, so now we get a description of the four beasts. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. So pause there. I mean, there's more description to come, but this is the really material description. You have a lion with eagle's wings, or at least with buzzard's wings. Okay, so that's the first beast. Now, let me give you a little of the let me finish this, sorry. I feel like a DJ, I've got so many records spinning here. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground. So notice how it's not in control. There's a greater power that can pluck off its wings and lift it up from the ground. And it was made to stand, again, passive. So there's someone making it to stand on 2 feet like a man. But that's the only way that it's like a man, just standing on its 2 feet. So you keep the human imagery really out of it. It's just ultimately a lion reared up on its feet. And the mind of a man was given to it. So not the mind of a beast, but the mind of a man. Now, if you had something that was like think just very narrowly in terms of Daniel as a literary unit itself, was there anything that you heard about where a beast was suddenly given the mind of a man? So Nebuchadnezzar loses his mind and takes on the form of a beast and then is given the mind of a man. Okay, so that's going to be the referent here. And that's going to be one of many reasons why we can tell that this is a description of the first kingdom, Babylon, of the gold head from the imagery of the Colossus. All right, so let me read a little to you. Bear with me here. This is the most efficient way to do it. The first beast, a lion with eagle's wings. The kingdom represented by the first beast, the creature, quote, like a lion, end quote, with, quote, wings of an eagle, end quote, is Babylon, as commentators of all stripes have acknowledged. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, is compared to a lion in Jeremiah 4 and Jeremiah 50. The Babylonian king, nation, or armies are compared to eagles in Jeremiah, and there's three different references in Jeremiah, in Ezekiel, in Habakkuk, and in Lamentations. So that's where this imagery of the lion with the eagle's wings comes from in terms of biblical literature. The specific description of the wings as of an eagle probably combines the concepts of swiftness and flight with the ability to attack like a bird of prey. The time when the lion still has its wings and can travel quickly represents the rapid expansion of the Neo-Babylonian Empire under Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar, so the great expansion that Babylon had. But that expansion then comes to an end. So it has wings. Those wings are plucked. Now it can't quickly expand. During Nebuchadnezzar's reign, that expansion slowed, as signified by the plucking of the wings from the lion. Eventually, however, the lion was made to stand upright and given a man's mind. This is an obvious reversal of the transformation of Nebuchadnezzar, whose human mind or heart was taken away, and he was given the mind or heart of an animal. Some commentators see here a reference to the restoring of Nebuchadnezzar's sanity. And possibly also to add to that, if Nebuchadnezzar died a Christian, he received the mind of a man, the last thing we hear of Nebuchadnezzar is he's giving praise to the one true God, as though he has finally learned his lesson. I suppose the counter-argument would be he appears to learn his lesson many times and then proves otherwise that he hasn't learned his lesson. A little bit more on this. Some commentators see here a reference to the restoring of Nebuchadnezzar's sanity. My reason returned to me. However, the only time that the Aramaic noun for mind in 7:4 is mentioned in reference to Nebuchadnezzar is when he loses his sanity. Other vocabulary is used for the restoration of his sanity in 4:31 and 33. The transformation of the lion is an ironic twist on the earlier narrative. Since an animal is given a human mind, the exact opposite of Nebuchadnezzar's experience. Moreover, the detail about the lion being made to stand on its feet is not mentioned at all in Daniel 4. Instead of recalling Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, the humanizing of this beast represents the lessening ferocity of the Babylonian Empire under its later kings. Okay, so ultimately he takes that, was given the mind of a man to be ceased to be quite so bestial in its conquest and its bloodlust of human and its control over human beings and started to act in a way more humane. All right, so do with that info what you will, but there's the first beast, Babylon, corresponding to the gold head of the Colossus with its eagle's wings and its upright stance and its mind of the man all explained. Let me pause there, see if you have any thoughts before we move on to the second. One all the way up front here. I should get a stopwatch, see if you get faster as the weeks go on, since it's like training. I bet you've gotten faster over the weeks.
Okay.
Give you your 40 time or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Oh. Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. If the ancient glazed tiles from the gates of ancient Babylon depict a lion. The lion is the symbol of Babylon, represents da-da-da-da-da-da. And they have the gates in the British Museum.
Oh, nice.
Do you think that's correlating?
Yeah, sure. Okay. It sure could. It's not something Steinman makes the case for, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, a big blue tile.
Very nice detail. Yeah, thanks. Okay, any other thoughts on the first beast? On to the second. Okay, verse 5. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It's a really weird description, isn't it? So it's like a bear on all fours, but it's kind of cockeyed like this. We'll hear a description of what that might indicate in just a moment. But yeah, it's kind of got this cockeyed stance. It's raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. Ooh, grotesque imagery. These are, I'll get National Geographic on you for a minute. These are ribs freshly torn from the carcass. They're raw, bloody, mangled things with flesh hanging down. This is an ugly picture of a bear that's got its fangs wrapped around, you know, this look, a lopsided bear with its fangs wrapped around a raw rib cage. Really gruesome image. So it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." Now that's interesting, because already in the first beast, in the second beast, and we'll hear echoes of this in the beasts to come, there's some greater power. There's some greater power plucking off wings and raising the lion so it stands. There's some greater power speaking to the bear and giving it dominion. Wonder who that is. Well, we already know, of course, from Daniel that this is the Lord, that even he has these terrible beasts well under control. So we could translate this in a very comforting way, that no matter how large, how powerful, how wicked, how tyrannical a kingdom of this earth becomes, God not even once is like, "Oh no, what am I going to do?" He's got it completely in hand, completely under control. And so we as his saints can rejoice in his true reign and also in his power over the beasts, his power over the kingdoms of this world, no matter how ferocious they might be. Okay, that brings to an end then the biblical description of this second beast, this bear. Let's jump into a little commentary so we can connect some of the pieces. Quoting from Steinman once more. In the scriptures, bears are often associated with lions as fierce and dangerous predators. So you know that because isn't that part of David's speech to Saul where he says, I've killed lions and bears, so I can go kill this giant too. So bears often connected with lions. On one side, this bear was raised up, a reference to verse 5. This is a reference to God granting greater dominion to the Persians in the empire consisting of both Medes and Persians. Makes absolute sense, doesn't it? You have the Medo-Persian Empire that follows. It's got these two sides, but it's one unit. And one side is raised up above the other. One side is more powerful and more dominant than the other in this bear. And that's the Persian side. And of course, let me just continue. Otherwise, I'll end up saying it to you twice. This is a reference to God granting greater dominion to the Persians and the empire consisting of both the Medes and the Persians. The raised side is a strong indication that this beast represents Media Persia and not simply Media, as critical scholars claim. The difference is of great importance. If the beast only represents Media, or the second kingdom, then Persia and Greece would be the third and fourth kingdoms, and God's kingdom should have arrived during the Greek era, which of course it did not. So that's why he's saying it matters to get this right, and it matters to stand your ground. Okay, so then we know what the lopsidedness of the bear indicates. What about the three ribs in its mouth? How about that? The three ribs in the bear's mouth represent conquests by the Medo-Persian Empire. One is tempted to identify them as the major conquests of Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. If the Aramaic term meant teeth instead of ribs, they could represent three particularly prominent kings of Persia. However, these kinds of attempts at specific identifications are mere speculations and cannot be proven with any certainty. Instead, the number should be understood as symbolic in import. The three ribs represent the substantial but limited power of the bear to devour. The Medo-Persian Empire will not devour the entire world, so the bear does not have an entire set of ribs in its mouth. Since ribs occur in pairs, a full set would require an even number. But the Medo-Persian Empire will dominate a good part of the world, so its power is to be feared. While Daniel is looking at the bear, it is being commanded, arise, devour much flesh. This command denotes divine authorization for the Medo-Persian dominion over the ancient Near East. God allows this warfare as part of his plan of preparation for the coming of his kingdom through the Son of Man. All right, that's what we have on the second beast, with the imagery fairly well explained, some other possibilities given, but in all likelihood, the three ribs indicates a ferocity, but a divine limitation to what the bear can devour. And again, that's Persia, which corresponds to the silver or made of the chest and the arms in the statue. That's second kingdom. So Babylon, gold head, Persia, silver chest and arms. Shall we move on to the third? Okay. So for the third, we're going to pick up at verse 6. After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. Okay, so interesting, because we had a lion with eagle's wings. Now we have a leopard with bird wings and four of them. I wonder if it looked like some kind of weird butterfly thing. Four wings. And the beast had, four heads. And dominion was given to it. Now, as we did before, look at the passive. Dominion was given to it. It didn't have dominion. It had to be given dominion. And we have this third beast come out. And we know that that's going to correspond to the Greeks, or in the vision in chapter 2, the bronze, which was the middle and the thigh, the bronze middle and thighs of the Colossus, here corresponding to the leopard with four wings of the bird on its back, that has dominion given to it. Okay, a little less detail to reckon with here, but still some. Let me read to you a bit from the commentary on the third beast, a leopard with four wings and four heads. The third beast resembles a four-winged, four-headed leopard. The leopard, known as a swift animal, is made more swift by a double set of wings. Unlike the lion's wings, which were described more specifically as wings of an eagle, the wings on this third creature are simply called bird wings. Since it has the unnatural number of four bird wings, the implication is that these four wings could take advantage of the four winds of heaven from verse 2. Thus, Daniel saw a vision of a speedy and mobile animal. So you have a leopard, obviously speedy, agile. And then you've got these four wings corresponding to the four winds. So speed, speed, speed. That's the imagery. While the rise of both the Neo-Babylonian and Medo-Persian empires was relatively fast, the speedy rise of Alexander's Greek empire was without equal in the ancient Near East. Alexander began his conquest of Persia in May 334 BC and continued to conquer territory until the revolt of his troops at Opis in August of 324. So think of that conquest happening in like 10 years. It's wild. Absolutely wild what Alexander could accomplish and the speed of it. In one short decade, the Macedonian king had established an empire more vast than any that preceded it. The four wings able to fly on the four winds in all four compass directions, north, south, east, west, on an already swift animal, predict and symbolize this stunning achievement by Alexander the Great. Okay, how about the four heads? It's a little bit more challenging. many interpreters who rightly understand this third creature to represent the Greek domination of the ancient Near East view its four heads as the four major kingdoms into which Alexander's empire was split by the Greek rulers who followed him. The later Greek rulers and their territories were Antigonus in Greece and Macedon. Oh gosh, I can never pronounce this one. Lysimachus in Thrace and Asia Minor. Seleucus I Nicator in Syria and Babylon. And Ptolemy I Soter in Egypt and Palestine. This interpretation seems to be influenced by Daniel 8:8 and also Daniel 8:21 through 22, where the goat representing Greece has four horns that represent four kings who succeed one great horn, Alexander. However, here in 7:6, the four heads do not replace one head. So the heads in Daniel 7 are not parallel to the horns in Daniel 8. Boy, I'm going to have to try to remember that. Otherwise, I'll mess it all up. One of you will catch me. Just a little bit more. Moreover, Daniel 7 never states the symbolic meaning of the heads. Therefore, it is more probable that the four heads, like the leper's four wings, derive their symbolism from the four winds of heaven. Thus, the leopard's four heads probably indicate that it has ambition and vision for conquest in all four directions, toward all corners of the earth. While the four heads may also anticipate the later breakup of Alexander's kingdom into four pieces, it is premature to speak about the heads as four separate kingdoms, since this detail will not be revealed until the following vision in Daniel 8. And there, it is symbolized by four horns, not heads. So, I mean, a preview into chapter 8, you can see how detailed. I mean, God knows everything that's going to happen. I know we know that, but don't you have to marvel when you actually see it, and when you actually see it playing out via the politics of the world that seem to be all too human and all too much in the control of wicked men? God's like, no, it's all according to plan. It's going right the way I anticipated it would. So God can foresee things, not only the four kingdoms, but in chapter 8, he foresees that this third kingdom, Greece, its main horn will be replaced by four other horns. The kingdom of Alexander will be divided in four. And of course, as you noted, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids are the one most important to the Holy Land. The Ptolemies the most important. And so when you're looking at the world in which Jesus arrives, you're getting closer and closer, because right after the Greeks, after the Ptolemies, you have the Romans come in, and then our Lord is born. Okay, any thoughts then on the third beast, the Greeks, the bronze, middle and thighs, this third kingdom? Four-headed leopard, four wings on the back. Okay, then on to, now you remember we had gold, we had silver, we had bronze, and then we had iron and clay. So the fourth was not like the third. Look what we're going to see again. Now picking up at verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. Now already we note a difference, don't we? We note a difference on the one hand because they're all previously described like with organic language. You've got the lion, that's an organic, with eagle's wings. And then you've got, he stands up like a man and he has the mind of a man. The second one's a bear and he's got ribs. It's just all earthly, organic type stuff. And then you've got the leopard. And he's got four heads and four wings. That's weird, but they're four leopard heads and four birds' wings. So again, it's still all organic and understandable in the natural world. But then when you see this fourth beast, not only is it described in this way that none of the other beasts are described as being terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong, but then it has these iron teeth, which is something not organic and not natural and not found in the animal world. So that's one of the ways in which it's different right off the bat. Now, you've probably already noticed, too, that in the fourth kingdom and the Colossus, okay, first gold, second silver, third bronze, fourth, you have iron, along with the iron and clay feet, but you have iron, and now look what's mentioned here. Iron in the fourth. So a further identifier so that we know we're talking about the same thing. So this fourth kingdom is the kingdom of the Romans, of iron legs and iron and clay feet, and here depicted as a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It has great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. Which is kind of a beautiful imagery that these kingdoms are not really a blessing to humanity. These kingdoms are coming in and tearing and trampling. They're known by oppression and bloodshed. And not that that resembles any of our modern nation states at all. They certainly don't oppress their people or shed a bunch of blood. And for the YouTube algorithm, I said not, don't. These things definitely and most certainly don't oppress people or shed blood. I got policed. So, as you can tell, I'm a little bitter about it. Nah, just teasing. Okay, let's jump back in then. We've got this fourth beast, terrifying, dreadful, exceedingly strong, iron teeth, devouring, breaking in pieces, stamping what was left with its feet. So there's a sense in which, I mean, humanity, but especially the saints of God, are just getting trampled under these kingdoms. And this is the history of God's people, too, if you think about it. I mean, it's one of the reasons why there's this silent period, because God's people, and here I just mean the saints, per se, who have their faith in the coming Messiah, are just, I mean, they have to survive beast after beast after beast as the generations go on, as these kingdoms reign over them. And so that's what's in view here. It was stamping what was left with its feet. Now here explicitly we're told, I mean, we already had enough to guess this, but here explicitly we're told it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Normally a beast would have 2 horns. This one has 10 horns. Verse 8, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. Now again, we're noticing the passive language returning. So the first horn, the 3 of the first horns were plucked up. Who's plucking them up? Again, this is a reference to God having dominion over these beasts and doing as he will. Okay, so you've got then 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And then you've got this little one that was mentioned before, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. Oh, I bet it was preaching the gospel. Nope. The great things, of course, like great, swelling, pompous, arrogant things. That's the language for great things. Okay, so it's tough imagery. We get much more detail. This great beast note how there's no animal descriptor. There's no form. This thing kind of defies any sort of simple. It's just a beast different than all the other beasts. And it's got these iron teeth, so it's got all these unnatural elements. And we can't even picture, I mean, what comes into my mind immediately is a dragon, but we're just not even told that imagery explicitly. So it's got this head with 10 horns, and then there pops up an 11th horn, this little horn, and then 3 of the 10 are ripped out. And then this little horn, like, talk about creeping you out in the middle of the night. It's got eyeballs. It looks like a man. And then it starts, you know, speaking bombastic, hubristic things. All right, let's dig into the commentary. Let's get a little background on this. The fourth beast, different from the other beasts. Daniel does not describe the fourth beast as he sees as resembling any natural animal. Instead, he describes it by its effect on him, frightening and terrible, and its strength, exceedingly strong. The same adjective for strong describes the fourth kingdom represented by the statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. So there's that linguistic connection between chapter 2 and chapter 7, the fourth kingdom and the fourth kingdom. The fourth beast's iron teeth are reminiscent of the fourth metal iron in the shins and feet of the statue. This beast also crushed and trampled with its feet. Just as the fourth kingdom represented by Nebuchadnezzar's statue had the ability to crush and shatter. Therefore, the fourth beast represents the same kingdom, Rome, as the fourth part of the statue, the iron shins and iron and clay feet. This beast is the only one described as recklessly destructive. The bear would, quote, devour, and the leopard had, quote, dominion, but only the fourth beast was so destructive that it, quote, devoured and crushed, and what was left it trampled with its feet. So, yeah, that's a pretty thoroughgoing destruction. This is an apt description of cruel Roman power and Rome's willingness to use that power ruthlessly to subdue conquered peoples. Daniel notes one major difference between this fourth animal and the others. It has horns. A natural horned animal would have only two. The 10 horns mark this beast as exceedingly powerful. Horns are often depicted as power. You know this from the rest of the scriptures, no doubt. So this has 10. This has exceedingly great power. Already in chapter 1, verse 20, the number 10 is used in a symbolic manner to indicate a quality that surpasses all others. The king deems the wisdom of the Judeans to be 10 times better than that of his occult diviners. The horns of an animal signify its power. Just as a horn can represent God's power to save his people, Psalm 18, Psalm 132, Luke 1, the horn of salvation. Therefore, the unnatural number of 10 horns signifies the unique character of this animal that sets it apart from the others. It surpasses them all in its power. And certainly Rome did that, and in its cruelty. All right, what about the little horn with the creepy eyes? You want to hear about that? Okay, let's do it. If you get nightmares, I'm not going to be held liable. Exactly. That's good. Okay, Daniel's attention has shifted from the beast as a whole to its 10 horns, which caught his attention because they made the beast different from the others. As he is contemplating the horns, a little horn arises on the beast, and three of the previous horns are uprooted in front of it. The passive verb once again implies divine action, right? That God's uprooting these horns. He has perfect control even over this beast, as terrible as it is. The uprooting is done with God's permission, and it also demonstrates the power of the little horn. Interpreters often assume that by uprooting the three horns, the little horn inherits their former power. However, the fact that only three of the 10 horns are uprooted implies that only part of the power of the beast is exercised by the little horn. So by that way of thinking, the little horn has 30% of the power of the beast, right? Okay. The little horn's eyes and mouth, gross, reveal that the horn represents a human institution, just as the other horns represent human kings or kingdoms. The eyes denote the ability to observe and may also imply intelligence. The quote-unquote great things the little horn speaks are polemical words against God and his saints according to the subsequent explanation in the vision. And we're going to look on to chapter 7, verse 21. When we get there, it'll be explained how these kingdoms are arrayed against the saints and the one whose blood is being shed, the one who are being trampled under feet and devoured. I mean, while these are scourges on all of humanity, these bestial nations, God cares specifically about his saints and the endurance of his saints. So that really takes on the high point and the highlight. And that's true for, I mean, we should take that to heart and take great comfort in that while God looks at the nations of the earth and sees their bloodlust and destructive powers and oppressive powers, and yeah, he cares generally for all of humanity. It's the saints in particular that are the apple of his eye, and the saints in particular that draw out his sympathy and his own desire to destroy and cast down the nations. Okay. Let me just find where I left off here and jump back in. Yeah, these are polemical words, the great things the little horn speaks. And they're spoken against God and his saints, as we'll see later on in this chapter. This little horn is the only entity in the entire chapter that is depicted as specifically attacking God's people. I'd agree with the specificity, but the implication is that it's all a broader attack on God's people. Okay, the beast with the 10 horns and then the little horn is the Old Testament background for the second beast, the beast from the earth, conjured up by Satan in Revelation 13. In Revelation, this beast has horns like a lamb, imitating the Lamb of God, but speaks like a serpent or dragon. Its ultimate master, Satan. Later in Revelation, this beast mutates into the harlot. You remember this from chapter 17 and 19. And then into the false prophet. And that's a morphing that takes place between 17, or no, excuse me, preceding 17, so Revelation 16. Okay, so I don't know, other than turning this into a class on Revelation 13, which I was hoping to avoid, you get this second beast. It's conjured up from the earth. Okay, it looks like a lamb, but speaks like a dragon. It looks like the Lamb of God, but speaks like the devil. This is the Antichrist. And then this image of this beast that comes up from the earth morphs into the false prophet and morphs into the harlot. So these are all imageries for the false, the Antichrist, the false Christ. And then the harlot is really kind of the anti-church. He embodies the anti-church, the way Christ embodies the bride. And the woman who drinks his blood unto righteousness, the harlot drinks the blood of the saints unto her great damnation. So there's an anti-church there that also has its sacrament, namely the blood of innocence. Okay. Therefore, back to Steinman for just a moment, the fourth beast in Daniel 7, and in particular its little horn, represents the Antichrist. Interesting. The Book of Concord says the Antichrist is the papacy. Where's the papacy located again? Oh, yeah, that little pesky detail. Okay, therefore the fourth beast in Daniel 7, and in particular, is its little horn. Or excuse me, I think I botched that grammar because I was looking at my text here. Therefore, the fourth beast in Daniel 7, and in particular its little horn, represents the Antichrist. This little horn is not to be equated with the one in Daniel 8. I'm going to have to remember that too, which represents Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Okay, so we're going to have to make some distinctions between Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, but clear enough that then we have a foreshadowing and prophecy of the Antichrist, this little horn that emerges in Rome that takes on a certain amount of the Roman power. He has the eyes of a man, and he has a mouth speaking great things against God and against his saints, as he continues to do very obviously today. All right. Anybody ready for some good news? How about anything remaining on this fourth kingdom, this fourth beast, which of course corresponds to the Romans, the iron legs and the iron and clay mixed feet?
Does this correlate? Okay, Rome, the Roman Empire, mm-hmm. lasted 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. That's something like 10 times 10. Mm. And Christianity was made legal by Constantine in 313, approximately three 100 years. Mm. And three horns. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know.
And they were very cruel.
10 times 10, I think, is 100.
But anyway.
But at this,
I'm not very good with numbers.
Yeah, at this hour, my brain feels like spaghetti. I've been talking all day and thinking all day. It's interesting to contemplate those things. Well, we certainly have a sort of indication in the scriptures themselves that we should contemplate numbers and occurrences in history and these kinds of things that we might otherwise see as chaos or chance or just, you know, dismiss it as, well, isn't that curious? But of course we know that God is the author of all things, so where we see those particularities, we should be willing to at least consider, I wonder if that's explicitly the hand of God. We know the hand of God is in everything, but I wonder if that's kind of an explicit indicator for us. All right, well, just like in Daniel chapter 2, where we think of the four nations comprising the Colossus, there's actually a fifth, isn't there? The little stone that comes and shatters the feet and brings the whole thing down. That stone that then becomes the mountain that fills the earth. So that kingdom of Christ is really the fifth nation. And lo and behold, what do we have dramatically when we turn the page in the Lutheran Study Bible? As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. So now we get the fifth and heavenly kingdom. And it is that little stone that then fills the earth like a mountain. Now we get a different view of that kingdom as well, and one that's so much more explicit and just so wonderful. I mean, this vision has all kinds of dimensionality to it and import to it. This scene of the throne room, we have thrones plural, we don't know how many, there's at least two, and that would correspond to the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. So we have at least two thrones. And this throne room of heaven and this episode in Daniel also find their correspondence in Revelation. I mean, surprise, surprise, right? I don't know how he did it. John receives the heavenly vision of Revelation. And then I wonder if he like opened the book of Daniel and was like, uh-huh, oh, but this was slightly different. Right? Because there is such heavy correspondence between the two. But anyway, this scene that we're seeing here, you can also find a parallel to in Revelation chapters 4 and 5, if you remember. The throne room's empty. Everybody's mourning. Wait, mourning in heaven? Yes, mourning in heaven. Because no one is found who is worthy to open the scroll, the seal of the scrolls, and then Christ emerges and is fit to open and he's enthroned. Okay, and then Revelation 19 and 20, which obviously is toward the end and the enthronement of Christ over the new heavens and the new earth, that's ultimately what that enthronement's for. Okay, so let's get a little ways in. Let's just get over the very top of it, and we'll dig into the details next week. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. So a throne with wheels. We see that in Revelation. We see that in Ezekiel. In Ezekiel, the wheels have eyes because they're angels, and the throne itself consists of the four living creatures. And so now when we see fiery flames, you remember from Hebrews, his servants are a flame of fires or fiery flames. So what we're actually seeing here is his throne is fiery flames that is comprised of angels. And the wheels were burning fire, comprised like angels, these ministering spirits, these flames of fire. So yeah, that's another thing about heaven. You're like, oh, look at the fire. And you don't realize that the fire is a living creature, or many combined together. That's the angelic world in the world of heaven, is that many of what we would kind of consider to be objects are in fact angels. Oh, there's God's chariot. Cool. It's four living creatures. Oh, look at the wheels on the chariot. Aren't those interesting? They're each uniquely angels, covered in eyes, flaming fire. All right, so here is the Ancient of Days. What does he look like? Does he look like a beast?
No.
Nope. He's got clothing.
But
it's white clothing. He's got hair. And inevitably, then he has a head. He's got the hair of his head is white wool. See, so when you get white hair, it's just proof that you're approaching divinity. It's the glory of man to have white hair. You know, when my hairdresser was like, you should really color this, I think to myself, you don't know Daniel 7. When God can choose his hair color, any choice he wants, he chooses what? White. Yeah. Okay. So he is in the image of what? A human being. A human being. He's got clothing. He's got hair of his head. He's got a throne that he sits upon. And then 10, a stream of fire issued and came out from before him. The fire has already been likened with angelic beings. And so the angelic beings proceed out from him. This fire proceeds out from him. And then that's why what comes next? 1,000,000 served him. So the fires and the angels, these ministering spirits all around. And 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. God likes a lot. Full stop. God likes a lot. He likes a lot of people. He likes a lot of angels. He just likes a lot. He's enough for them all. And he loves huge, vast numbers. So those are his servants. And then look what happens next. The court sat in judgment and the books were opened. Ooh. Remember when we talked earlier about the potentiality of the council and the heavenly courtroom and angels earlier in Daniel, the watchers being involved. So here's another one that's emerging right in front of us. Now, I know we're a minute over. Bear with me because I just want you to see the next part. What I want you to do for the sake of our brevity is just jump to 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. So who's this? It has to be Jesus. He's the son of man. He's born of a man, but he's also divine, enthroned with God. And he's brought to the Ancient of Days. So now we know the Ancient of Days is the Father. But what does the Father look like? Interestingly, like a human being. And then the Son looks like a human being, and then Adam looks like a human being, and Christ looks like a human being. Isn't this interesting? And a very, very fascinating way of thinking about the image and likeness of God. Normally, I think we think of the Father as like just nothing or just pure spirit. And as much as those things might have their truth and their way about them via biblical revelation, here is a unique image of the Father himself looking like a man, namely the Ancient of Days. All right, that's it. The Lord be with you.